wonder what in the world is going on in the world. Even last night, and I got another text this morning that my uncle, Tom, is in the hospital in Othello and not doing very well at all. He collapsed at the Grant County Fair and has been tested for COVID and is positive. And my cousin's wife texted us all today and said he's not doing very well. So that's a new thing. And then my cousin Tony from over there too just is being tested for possible kidney cancer. So some pretty big stuff going on there. But I think we're all faced with pretty big things. Just want to let you know, America is going through some pretty difficult, unprecedented, difficult days, in my opinion. So if you're an American and you've been living in Afghanistan, if you are a Christian living in Afghanistan, if you have a Bible app on your phone and you've been living in Afghanistan, if you are a woman living in Afghanistan or a girl, this is not a very safe place to be. And I have watched in dismay over the events that have taken place and the reaction of our nation toward those events. I am stunned and very sad about what's happening there. That's a pretty big deal. And so if you have social media, you have Facebook, I wrote these down, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, YouTube, Snapchat, Reddit, TikTok, WhatsApp, Tumblr, Facebook Messenger, Vimeo, Periscope, Facebook Live, or if you watch the news on TV the old-fashioned way, or you have email access, you are bombarded with images and thoughts that are incredibly, incredibly powerful and have to have an impact on our psyche, on our the way we think. David said, I go to bed at night and I sleep. But I don't know if a lot of Americans really sleep well under these presents. Maybe you do. Maybe you go to bed and God's on the throne and you're good with that, and that's wonderful. But I think a lot of people in our culture are not sleeping well right now. I think people are dazed. I think people are bewildered. I think many people are afraid. Many people are depressed. And I think it's a very real thing going on around us. And then we're dealing with the COVID virus and what to do about it, whether it's social gathering, whether it's to hold hands across the sanctuary, whether it's to sing, whether it's to chant, whether it's to gather at all, whether it is to wear masks, whether it is to have the vaccination or not, at risk of losing jobs. There are, whether it's virtual schooling, this has been a year and a half at least of pretty new normal for us in our country, isn't it? If you agree, shake your head, okay? I can't imagine anybody going like this. So,
there's a reason for not being in the book of John this week, only a few reasons, but the main reason is that I want to make sure that the children's church and the sermons are in sync. And I just came across this chapter in this book by John Tolson. And it's a book called The Four Priorities. It's a book that I'm using with a couple guys. I plan to use it with others in a grooming, discipling sort of discipleship ministry. But in one of the chapters, he talks about depression and the reality of depression. And, you may not be depressed. Maybe when you go home today, I will have succeeded in depressing you a little bit. That's not my intention at all. But in the Bible, there is a prophet of God named Elijah who suffered from depression. So in 1 Corinthians 10, it says that all of that was written in Scripture for our instruction to help us. And I think if we're real about being a human being in these days, we deal with depression, we deal with some of that reality. So I'm going to give you a little bit of background to that, first of all. If you want the context for the life of Elijah, and we're not going to even scratch the surface on his life, but this is Ahab's, first of all, Ahab was the king in the northern kingdom of Israel, and he had an evil reign. He was an evil king. Of course, they all were in the northern kingdom of Israel, but he was the worst. He was one of the last. He was his evil reign, if you want to read in 1 Kings 16, 29 through 22:40, you can read all about Ahab. And of course, he married Jezebel. And I jokingly say that nobody names their kid, their daughter, Jezebel. Are there any Jezebels in the room? Anybody name their girls Jezebel? You know what Jezebel means? I think the Jews picked it. Means dunghill. So who in the world would name their daughter Jezebel? Nobody. But Ahab was a wicked king. I'll give you a little bit of background here. The historical period kings covers totals about 413 years. It goes from Solomon's coronation as king, Saul, David, Solomon, the third king of the United Kingdom, as co-regent with David, and then it goes all the way through Jehoiakim's release from Babylonian captivity in 561 BC. So it's about 400 years. Most of Kings deals with the period that spans Solomon's coronation and the destruction of Jerusalem in 586 BC. And so that would be the period at the beginning when Solomon built the temple in Jerusalem, and the end would be when the temple was burnt and destroyed. So 1 Kings and 2 Kings talks about why the nation of Israel fell from the heights of national prosperity to the depths of conquest and exile. Under Joshua, the promised land had been hard won and hard organized under the judges. But now the kings are taking the stage, and during the reign of the kings of Israel and Judah, the nation went into exile because of its unfaithfulness to God. So the nation of Israel fell. It went into exile, into God's chastening punishment because of its unfaithfulness to God. And so that kind of sets the stage for King Ahab. There's a little bit more, his wickedness. If you want to turn to 1 Kings chapter 16, because this is the context for the stepping onto the stage by Elijah the prophet. So I'm gonna pull that bottom piece out of there, okay? Just because. Can you just move that for me? When I'm sitting down, it's too high. There we go. Okay. So, 1 Kings chapter 16. Thank you, Kathy. And verse 29. This is some of the wickedness of King Ahab. So, verse 29 says, "Now Ahab, the son of Omri, who was a bad enough dude all of his own." Okay, he was a wicked king. But things kind of got even worse under Ahab. So Ahab, the son of Omri, became king over Israel in the 38th year of Asa, king of Judah, in the southern kingdom. And Ahab, the son of Omri, reigned over Israel in Samaria 22 years. Ahab, the son of Omri, did evil in the sight of the Lord more than all who were before him. Boy, how would you like that record on your tombstone? This guy did worse than everybody who was before him. Wow, what a epitaph, right? So it came about as though it had been a trivial thing for him to walk in the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, that he married dunghill. I don't mind that word because it's kind of, we don't use it much, but he married Jezebel, and the daughter of Ethbaal, king of the Sidonians, Tyre and Sidon, over by the Mediterranean, north of Israel, and went to serve Baal and worshipped him. So this was a change from a time when the kings were leading the people kind of away from the worship of the Lord, like they were kind of failing at it, to a replacing Yahweh, the God of Israel, with the god Baal, the small g god Baal. And Ahab also made the Asherah. Thus Ahab did more to provoke the Lord God of Israel than all the kings of Israel who were before him. God was ticked. God was extremely angry with Ahab. And in his days, Hiel and the Bethelite built Jericho. He laid its foundations, which the loss of Abram, his firstborn, and set up its gates with the loss of his first youngest son. Say, and they would take the remains of a child that died and actually put them inside the walls. So it was almost like a mausoleum sort of thing. That's what's going on here. Which he spoke by Joshua, the son of Nun. So there was extreme wickedness on the part of Ahab, unusually wicked. Ahab was the worst king, but Ahab exceeded him in wickedness. Ahab, and when he married Jezebel, he just basically, the man had the right of refusal to get married. There were arranged marriages, but the men for sure had the right of saying, no, I'm not going to marry that woman, even though my dad wants me to, even though my family wants me to. But it was a really unwise marriage. That's all I can say. When you look at Ahab and Jezebel and they got married, that was an unwise marriage. And it ended up in very bad circumstances. Ahab married unwisely. Solomon's foreign wives led him into idolatry. Ahab's wife did the same, with a vengeance. So this was the kind of unequally yoked situation that led away from devotion to the Lord. And it was a very unwise decision to marry. And so Ahab's greatest sin, however, was that he brought the worship of Baal, the worship of the native Canaanites, whom God had commanded Israel to exterminate. So God had said, and we read about this. I know you guys are just thinking, this is the happiest sermon I've ever heard. It's not, but that's okay. But the Canaanites were extremely wicked. If you were here when Brent Strasburg preached on the decision by the Lord to exterminate the Canaanites, he gave tons of reasons why. And I remember after the fact that, he was
God was justified in what he did with the Canaanites because of their extreme wickedness. And the worship of Baal was part and parcel of all of that. So Ahab went one step further. He officially replaced the worship of Yahweh with idolatry. And this was a first in the history of Israel. So idolatry, that's what's going on. So anyway, but it's interesting because in 1 Kings chapter 18, what's in there? That's the story, that's the account of Israel, I mean of now Elijah the prophet dealing with Ahab and Jezebel and the worship of Baal. And so the worship of Baal had been set up by Jezebel and Ahab, and Elijah the prophet, the spokesman for God, the preacher, the prophet, was standing up to Ahab and standing up to the idolatry of the country in an amazing way. And then in chapter 18, what happens there? You have the challenge of all of the prophets of Baal on one side and all of the prophets of Yahweh on the other side. And, you know, it's an amazing, amazing story. You remember what it is? Look at just a little bit of it. You guys probably heard this in Sunday school tons of times. But let's start with verse 27 of chapter 18. It came about at noon that Elijah mocked them and said, "Call out with a loud voice." That would be the prophets of Baal. They had set up two altars, one with meat on it and wood for a fire, and the other the same. And there was this challenge between Elijah, the prophet of Yahweh, and the prophets of Baal. And so when they cut themselves, they called out to Baal to consume their offering. And verse 27 says, "And it came about at noon that Elijah mocked them and said, 'Call out with a loud voice, for he is a god. Either he is occupied or gone aside, or he's on a journey, or perhaps he's asleep and he needs to be awakened.'" You know, that's kind of how Elijah addressed the prophets of Baal. "So they cried out with a loud voice and cut themselves with, according to their custom, with swords and lances until blood gushed out on them. And it came about at when midday was past that they raved until the time of the offering of the evening sacrifice, but there was no voice. No one answered, and no one paid attention. And then Elijah said to all the people, 'Come near to me.' So the people came near to him, and he repaired the altar of the Lord, which had been torn down. Elijah took 12 stones, according to the number of the tribes of the sons of Jacob, to whom the word of the Lord had come, saying, 'Israel shall be your name.' And so with the stones he built an altar in the name of the Lord, and he made a trench around it." Remember that? And large enough to hold 2 measures of seed. And then he arranged the wood and cut the ox in pieces and laid it on the wood. And then he said, "Fill 4 pitchers with water and pour it on the burnt offering and on the wood." And he said, "Do it a second time." And they did it a second time. And he said, "Do it a third time." And they did it a third time. And the water flowed around the altar, and he also filled the trench with water. And then it came about at the time of the offering of the evening sacrifice that Elijah the prophet came near and said, "O Lord, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and Israel, today let it be known that you are God in Israel, and that I am your servant, and I have done all these things at your word. Answer me, O Lord, answer me, that this people may know that you, O Lord, are God, and that you have turned their heart back again. And then the fire of the Lord fell and consumed the burnt offering and the wood and the stones and the dust and licked up the water that was in the trench. Wow. How would you like to be Elijah at that moment? You know, there's this big contest, and there's the prophets of Baal with no help, no voice out of heaven. Nothing happened. And then there's Elijah, who prays in the name and for the honor of Yahweh, and this is the result. It's in a spectacular miracle of the Old Testament, isn't it? It's an amazing one. But now, and there's other things we could look at, but look at chapter 19 and verse 1. Because now we're going to look at the human side of Elijah the prophet. Okay? So, verse 1. Now Ahab told Jezebel all that Elijah had done. So Ahab goes back to the dunghill and tells her all that Elijah had done and how he had killed all the prophets with the sword. And then Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah. All it took was a messenger, a word, someone coming with a message for Elijah, saying, "So may the gods do to me and even more if I do not make your life as the life of one of them by tomorrow about this time." What was that? That's what you call a death threat from the wife of the king. Okay, so it was Jezebel sending word to Elijah, and her words shook him to the core. Her words made him afraid. Her words, and many times our fear, our anxiety, our depression, what is that? What is all of that? It's usually focused on somebody, you know, somebody that's going to hurt me, someone that's going to destroy me, someone that's, you know, it's usually that, like when you're driving the car and you're going over the speed limit down the road and you're feeling anxious, worried. Well, what's worry? It's worried that there's going to be blue lights in the back of your mirror and somebody is going to deal with you. So depression, anxiety usually comes from somebody. And so Elijah was, look what it says in verse 3. And he was what? He was afraid. He was full of fear. And arose and did what? Ran for his life. It's amazing that he's standing between the prophets of Baal and the altar to the Lord Yahweh, and he sees the fire come down and consume the offering and vindicate God, and it's glorious. And then Jezebel is able to send him a little message, and he sends him, he's scared, maybe depressed, maybe anxious, maybe not able to sleep like David said he could. I don't know for sure. So I'm just going to go through real quickly some of the causes of depression. I'm not a counselor. I'm not a licensed psychiatrist. Don't worry about that. If I can get to there. The first symptom that I'm dealing with some kind of depression or anxiety is the symptom of fear. Sometimes we get depressed because we're afraid. We're afraid of somebody. We're afraid of COVID. We're afraid of the neighbor next door. We are afraid of our own government. We are afraid of lots of things. And so in verses 1, 2, and 3, it just says that Elijah, it says in verse 3, he was afraid and arose and ran for his life. So fear is a very real thing that can do lots of things in our life. I'm not going to spend time on that. The second symptom about Elijah is found, and it's the symptom of isolation. It says, and he was afraid and arose and ran for his life and came to Beersheba. That's about as far south as you can go. You know, when they talk about from Dan to Beersheba, it's way at the south. In fact, it's heading for the country where the children of Israel wandered for 40 years in the desert in unbelief. Isn't that something? He arose and was running into that area. But he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness, the very wilderness where the children of Israel wandered in unbelief. And he came and sat down under a juniper tree, and he was by himself. So I think one of the symptoms of that either is part of being depressed or is the cause of depression is isolation. And of course, isn't it amazing that God says in his word in Hebrews chapter 10, which I think we need to say over and over again to God's people today, and that is, he says, do not forsake the gathering of yourselves together. Do not forsake it. Don't quit doing it. Don't isolate yourself. Don't, you know, because in isolation, we find all kinds of trouble. Dr. Philip Zimbardo said, I know of no more potent killer than isolation. I'm not kidding you. You can say, well, I can just make it on my own. You can't. And you will do much better if you take someone out to lunch today, if you gather together with other believers on a regular basis as a habit in your life. So the other symptom was isolation. The next symptom is self-pity. And that's exactly what Elijah experienced. It says, but he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness and came and sat down under a juniper tree, and he requested for himself that he might die and said, it's enough now, O Lord, take my life, for I am not better, than my fathers. So there was just this self-pity, this which is a symptom of depression. It's just, it's an inward focus. It's being focused on me. And I think one of the huge things is the next one. It's symptom number 4 is faded faith. Look what it says in 1 Kings 19:4. But he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness and came and sat down under the juniper tree, and he requested. We already read that verse, but it's Are you awake out there? I'm sorry if this is too much information, but what I'm saying is, in chapter 18 of 1 Kings, he is what? Extremely victorious. He is full of the glory of the moment when God vindicates himself in front of all the prophets of Baal. It's the time for celebration. It's victory time. But now he has completely forgotten what God has done in his life. I think it's huge that his faith is faded. I'm going to ask you to do something right now, okay? I want you to tell me, can you remember, okay, I'll give you a few seconds to remember, but can you remember something that God did in your life? Can you remember a time when God stepped in what was a miraculous, an amazing, a life-changing way in your life? In just a few words, does anyone want to remember one of those things? Can anybody stand up and say, yeah, I remember this in my life when God came through? I'll give you an example while you're thinking, okay? When our daughter was in Nepal as a missionary, she, one of the first things they wanted to do was just kind of explore Nepal, and she signed up for a trek from Kathmandu clear across the country of Nepal, almost to Pakistan, on a bus. And I mean, it was like very, very hot, bad weather, you know, through the part of Nepal where the tigers are and the, you know, the bad animals and all that. It's like, what do they call that? Anyway, doesn't matter. But she went with a group from Kathmandu all the way across Nepal and drank the water and did what everybody did and shared the gospel, gave out literature, talked to people about Christ, and just did it all by faith. It was really a cool thing. But then she got typhoid fever. And I didn't know much about typhus back then, but she got it, and she was very sick. And I don't think she's ever told us how sick she really was, but I think she was really sick. And the bus was coming back into Kathmandu, and she was in really, really bad shape. And when she got back to Kathmandu, her friend, who was a woman from Switzerland, you know, was in Kathmandu, and her father, who was a physician, had flown that day into Kathmandu to visit Alicia's friend. And when he saw Alicia, he diagnosed her that day, prescribed medications, and she lived. And I'm just telling you, from mom and dad halfway around the world, that was an amazing God moment for which we give honor and glory to God. You can say it's a coincidence, but life is, there's a lot of coincidences out there. And so I don't know if you have a story that you want to share, but I could keep telling you some other ones too. But what has God done in your life? Stand up. Come on, tell us. Diane? Who was this? Your dad. Okay, your father. That's awesome. Thank you. Anybody else? Yes, Mary. Thank you. Amen. Okay. I don't want to keep you here all day, so if you got one, stand up. Otherwise, we're going to move on. All right. Thank you. Yeah, that's awesome. That's it? Okay, let's move on. But what I want to say here is that Elijah was in a fit of depression under a juniper tree in the south of Israel, and he forgot everything that God had done in his life. If you're depressed, I think you need to start thinking about what God has done. I think you need to make a list. I think you need to review it. You need to look at what God has done. I have a quick list here. Elijah had foretold that a famine was coming, and a famine came just like he foretold. That's pretty cool. Elijah was fed by ravens. I mean, we have to stop and think. We just read these stories. Yeah, the ravens came. No, the ravens came and fed Elijah supernaturally. That's a pretty big deal. If you read the story about the widow's barrel of flour and the jar of oil that never ran out, God showed up in Elijah's life in a big way. If you read about how God used Elijah to raise the widow's son from the dead in 1 Kings chapter 17. If you read about what we read about, the fire from heaven to consume the offering, that's an amazing thing. 1 Kings chapter 18. If you read about the rains returning at his request, that was pretty amazing what God had done, and his ability with supernatural strength to outrace the king's chariot in 1 Kings chapter 18. So all I'm saying is he was isolated, he was full of self-pity, and his faith had faded. He had forgotten what God had done in the middle of that. The next one is he was suicidal. Huge thing in our culture today. I already said those things, so he was suicidal. Remember he said, and he requested for himself that he might die. He requested for himself. That's what suicide is, actually a pretty self-centered, selfish kind of thing. Life is just too tough for me to handle, and so that's the way out. And it's not the way out. It's not. But many people think that it is. Here's what Abraham Lincoln said. This is an amazing quote for me. We've been looking at Abraham Lincoln quite a bit. He said, this was in the middle of his presidency, and he said, "I am now the most miserable man living." He said, "If what I feel were equally distributed to the whole human family, there would not be one cheerful face on the earth. Whether I shall ever be better, I cannot tell. I awfully forebode I shall not." That's depression. That's like turning inward and you know, and we don't understand what it would be like to carry the world on his shoulders like he did. But anyway, he did. The next one is exhaustion. I mean, if people are experiencing depression, one of the things that we ought to do, I think, is to get some rest. I think we ought to take time off. We really, exhaustion just contributes to the depression and the struggles that we're facing. In fact, we all know that during the times when we sleep, your brain reproduces, it produces dopamine and what's the other one? Serotonin. I don't know, whatever you need, your happy chemicals. But it happens while you're sleeping. And so getting rest, getting enough rest is pretty important. Some of us get too much rest. We need to wake up and get busy. We need to get to work. I mean, some people need to get up and get to work. I listened to a black man speaking this week at a school board meeting. Yeah, did you hear it? And I'm just giving you the gist of it. Maybe you saw that, but he stood up and he says, I just want you to know we've been dealing with critical race theory, racism, Black Lives Matter, all that stuff. And he says, I'm a black man, and my parents were black, and their parents were black, and their parents, 16 generation, were black. And he said they were part of the slaves. They were slaves in Alabama on my dad's side, in Texas on my mom's side. And he said, but I want to tell you living here today, I am not oppressed. I live in this country. I dress the way I want. I live where I want. I drive my car where I want to go. I, you know, all of that. And then he said, and here's what I tell my kids, and I can only remember 2 out of 3, but it doesn't matter. He said, there's only 3 things that you will make you a victim. One is if you consider yourself a victim, and if you are, you make stupid choices in life, it will affect your life. And then maybe you can remember the 3rd thing. Huh? Oh, and don't do anything. Yeah, basically don't do anything. How many of you heard that speech? I heard everybody in the school board meeting stood up and clapped for this guy. So I think he was, yeah. So we live in those days. I think God tells young men and old men, but young men, to not sit around and do nothing. You need to get out of your house once in a while and put the video games away and take on responsibility and take on jobs and go out and be useful and contribute to the greater good of our society. You do nothing, you become a victim. Anyway, you guys all know all that stuff. So, but exhaustion is, if you're doing all that, go ahead and get some rest. And then 3 characteristics of vital exhaustion. Number 1, feelings of excessive fatigue and lack of energy. Increasing irritability. You know, when we're tired, we're exhausted, we get irritable, and we feel demoralized. Those are evidences of exhaustion. And then feeling rejected. I think, Elijah felt rejected. He said, I have been very zealous for the Lord. I have been zealous for him. The Lord of hosts, for the sons of Israel, have forsaken your covenant, torn down your altars and killed your prophets with the sword, and I alone am left. Was that true? Not at all. That was not true, but that's how he was feeling. I'm the only one left, and they seek my life to take it away. And so he was feeling pretty rejected and alone. So here's some ways that God healed Elijah. You can just put it in your notes. This won't take long, and then we're going to be finish for this morning, but there's 7 ways, I think, that God healed Elijah or brought him out of the dumps, out of the dumps of depression. Okay, 1, God recognized that Elijah's depression was real. I'm going to tell you today, if you're a Christian, you might be subject to depression. I don't want to make you depressed by saying that. But to be a Christian does not mean that you are exempt from depression. We are not exempt from cutting ourselves when we, you know, mess with a sharp knife. And I believe that the mind is also part of the body, part of how God made us. And we tend to say, I remember Dr. Meyer at seminary. He told this story about these missionaries that went Christian, strong, committed, all-in believers who went to the mission field. And while they were there, they experienced really difficult things. One of their kids died. Something else happened. They had to come home from the mission field feeling defeated. But they thought, we're missionaries. We're above depression. We're above all of that. So they went on with life, and they were putting on the show that everything is great. We're strong Christians. We're the committed ones. But a couple years later, they were dealing with severe depression, and they went to see Dr. Meyer, and he said, well, when did this start? And they went back to 2 years earlier when they'd been on the mission field, and they had experienced and they went through what human beings have trouble going through in the loss of their child, and they had to deal with real depression. And so I think God treats Elijah in that sense, saying that depression is something real. Number two, God encouraged Elijah to rest. You'll have to read the story for yourself. I'm not going to pull up all the verses. God encouraged Elijah to rest. Number three, and this is probably pretty important, is that we tend to want to fix things and give great advice. And God didn't give Elijah counsel for a while. You know, he didn't try and straighten him out. Now you'll have to read that whole story in 1 Kings. And then number four, God allowed Elijah to explain his problem. I love God. And then God dealt with Elijah's false beliefs. And sometimes our minds are confused. Romans 12, 1 and 2 says that, I urge you therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies to God, a living sacrifice, which is your reasonable service of worship, and not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by what? By the renewing of your mind, thinking about the beliefs, because what we believe about God and what we believe about the Word of God is how we behave. I guarantee you, if you look at how people behave and you go, that doesn't make sense, I'm going to tell you that how they think is not right. So God dealt with Elijah's false beliefs, and then God gave Elijah something to do. You know, and that's... And then the last thing is that God gave Elijah a friend, so he wasn't isolated. So anyway, I don't know if you have dealt with depression recently, if you are depressed, if you know people who are. I cannot imagine our culture not having people who are really struggling with what's going on around us. But I want to just remind you that, like we read this morning, O Lord, how my adversaries have increased. Many are rising up against me. Many are saying of my soul, there is no deliverance for him in God. But you, O Lord, are a shield about me, my glory, and the one who lifts my head. God lifts our head. He is the one, David said that, the one who lifts my head. I was crying to the Lord with my voice, and he answered me from his holy mountain. And then David says, I lay down and slept. Isn't that great? How's your sleeping? Yeah, I think the more we know God, the more we know him, the more we are able to lay down and sleep. I awoke, for the Lord sustains me. I will not be afraid of 10,000. Sorry, I lost my place. I will not be afraid of 10,000s of people who have set themselves against me round about. Arise, O Lord, save me, O my God, for you have smitten all my enemies on the cheek. You have shattered the teeth of the wicked. Salvation, deliverance belongs to the Lord. Your blessing be upon your people. Amen. Okay. That's where we want to end, but let's sing our